This is a Sound Rebel podcast.
To work with us on your podcast, go to soundrebel.co.uk. Over the Influence is no longer just a podcast. Our online community is buzzing with people like you.
Hi, I'm Kelly, and I'm incredibly proud to be an Over the Influence community member. When I became a member, I got a double dose of the podcast every week, now that I had access to the premium pod, and I also loved the in-person Zoom calls, basically just getting to know like-minded people. Personally, it's been just over a year since I changed my relationship with alcohol, and I've honestly never felt better. My head is clearer, my relationships with friends and family members are better, and overall in life I just have way more energy. Thankfully, I never had a rock bottom, but Over the Influence made me realise I didn't need one. It's never too late to change for the better. So thanks for being there for me, OTI, and keep up the great work.
So if you want to join us, go to overtheinfluence.co.uk. To Over the Influence. It's absolutely marvellous to have you listening. Thank you so much. Before we get in to today's episode, which as per, it's an absolute cracker. It's quite scientific today. It's a different vibe. I'll come back to that in a sec. Bear with. Allow me to reintroduce ourselves and let you know a little bit about your OTI podcast hosts. My name's Sharon Hartley. Everybody calls me Shaz, based in Lancashire in the northwest of England. Four and a bit years now, alcohol-free, flipping heck. And I've just had a spate, actually, of social media memories of how I messed up Sober October over the years, which are just, pretty much quite awful. Anywho, changed all that in September 2018. Was only going to take 90-day break from alcohol and fully get back on it in the party season of December. It all changed. Everything changed. Something really bizarre happened. I began to enjoy alcohol-free life. I fell in love with sobriety and hands down managed to change my life completely. It's utterly, butterly glorious. Could talk about it for hours. In fact, we do on this podcast, but I don't do it on my own. Ben Anderson, new dad. Welcome back.
Hello. Yes, my name is Ben. I'm 34, live in Liverpool, fiancé to Gem, and dad to Leo.
Oh,
Leo was born 3 weeks
now.
Ago. I've been on paternity leave, and this is the first time, and we know that we are incredibly professional, and an episode, you wouldn't have even noticed that I've had a few weeks off for paternity leave, because of course an episode of Over the Influence has come out every single Monday without fail. We did a bit of a spate of mad pre-recording, didn't we, Shaz, before
we
went
had,
off on paternity leave?
Yeah, we had a really frazzled September,
yeah.
I think it's fair to say.
It was like, what are we doing today? Of course, we're recording another episode of Over the Influence. Yeah. But yes, it is. I'm a bit rusty because sleepless nights, you know, I'm very tired. And I can't remember how to do this. So I'm really glad that our guest today, usually we make our guests listen to us doing this intro, don't we? They're usually sitting there on the Zoom waiting for us to introduce and going, bloody hell, when are these two going to shut up? It's a bit different today. We've got Professor David Nutt on the podcast. And we had a very... Because you'd have heard that name. He's an author, he's a scientist, he's a doctor, he's a professor, he's everything that you can think of that's a clever job.
An ology.
David Nutt is probably... Honestly,
many ologies.
Ology at the end of it. Yeah. We had a very specific amount of time with him, so we didn't, you know, subject him to the long wanging on, the long-winded intros. We just went straight into the interview. But I suppose it's kind of different, but it's kind of cool because we can set it up and we don't usually do that in this little intro bit. So this is a really interesting conversation with our mate Dave.
Well,
oh, yes.
He said... Didn't they? Because me and Ben were like, it's an actual professor. Okay, it's Professor David Nutt. Put a shirt on. Right, let's sit up straight. And when we started chatting to Dave, we started with, hello, Professor Nutt. And Ben asked,
well, you'll hear in a minute,
Professor
yeah.
Nutt a question.
Our posh voices.
And
hello, Professor.
And what do you think of that, Professor Nutt? And he just went, oh, for goodness sake, listen, just call me Dave. And then we all breathed.
Call me Dave. But it's really interesting though, because this is the first time we've had a guest on the podcast who's not alcohol free, isn't it? Have we ever had a non-alcohol free guest on the podcast?
No,
I
don't think we have. No, we absolutely haven't, because You've got me thinking now. Just to cover ourselves, I'm going to say 99.9% of the people who come on this podcast are sharing a story of recovery, of sobriety, of how they've removed alcohol and it has just, you know, as we know, changed their lives. So this is a different episode. It's not one of those stories today, is it, Ben?
No, you know, I'm going to stick my neck out. I'm going to say that every single guest we've had on the podcast has been alcohol-free when we've recorded with them. Like, I'm pretty sure that that's the case.
You know what? Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, but there's no rules. But I suppose we're bending the rules today because this is Professor David Nutt, our mate Dave. Professor David Nutt, the name is one that you've probably heard of because he's an absolute legend when it comes to the alcohol-free space, despite not being alcohol-free himself. It's a really interesting argument that he generally presents. Like, we talk about a load of stuff in this episode, but he's a scientist and he thinks that you should, that everybody should know the science behind alcohol. They should know the facts. They should know that alcohol is dangerous, and then they should make their own decision about whether they want to drink or not. Now, he was fired, very famously fired from government in 2009, did he say, or 2008, Shaz?
Yeah, it was something like that.
You'll hear it in a minute. But he was fired because he said in a report that alcohol was the most dangerous drug to British society. At the time, a Home Office spokesperson said the Home Secretary has asked Professor David Nutt to resign as chair of the Advisory Council of the Misuse of Drugs. In a letter, he expressed surprise and disappointment over Professor Nutt's comments, which damage efforts to give the public clear messages about the dangers of drugs. We remain determined to crack down on all illegal substances and minimise their harm to health and society as a whole. At that point in time, alcohol wasn't even considered a drug by the government, and he was fired for saying that, basically. But then he also, you know, he owns a wine bar with his daughter. And it's just, it's this really interesting balance of somebody who has done a lot of the research. He's not a big drinker himself, but he does still drink. But he thinks that everyone should be able to make their own decision based on the science. And do we actually, are we taught enough about the dangerous effects of alcohol?
What's really interesting is, when he came on the call, and I think you're going to hear this bit as well, both myself and Ben were sitting there clutching his book like a right pair of sad sacks going, oh, hi, Professor David Nutt, look what we've got here, because you've read his book, Drink. And I have only recently half read it. Obviously, I'd heard about him and I've got this stack of quitlets still to get through. So when I went away on my AF holiday to Gran Canaria not so long ago, I read half of his book on the plane going out. And it does what it says on the tin. So it's called Drink? And it sets out in really simple terms, because if I can understand what this guy is talking about from a scientific point of view, you know, it must be simple. And I found it utterly fascinating to read. I wish I'd read it right at the start of my AF journey. Not that it would have made any difference, because I've never drunk and I'm never going to drink again. Simple as that. But he really does lay out the facts. And he's not preachy. He's not finger wagging. Like you say, he owns a wine bar with his daughter. Crack on, c'est la vie, each to their own. But what he does do is lay out the scientific facts about alcohol, what it does to you physically and mentally. And I think at the end of the book, it's simply a case of you choose. And yeah, we couldn't not get him on the podcast for this discussion, a very different discussion. And it's the science behind alcohol.
Yeah. Look, we totally get it if you don't think, having heard this intro, that this episode's for you. You want to hear stories of inspiration and people overcoming adversity and everything else? Cool. Come back next week because we've got a great one. But at the same time, this is a really interesting discussion with a very, very clever man. Many, many letters after his name. It's interesting and I hope you enjoy it.
I could barely pronounce, well, you'll hear it in a sec, his actual title. It's a very, very long word. I had to break it down phonetically. But as Ben just said there, if you think it's not for you, absolutely not a problem. But all I would say is, if you want to hear about the 47 symptoms of a hangover, if that's not going to put you off drinking for life, I don't know what is. Honestly, just maybe stick with it. Give it a try. See what you think. We really enjoyed it.
It's a really good job we didn't subject David Nutt to that intro, because that was probably our record.
It's the longest ever.
Right. Here he is. Professor David Nutt. Our mate Dave.
Hi,
going to try my very best and probably fail not to fangirl through this, Professor Nutt. Okay. Failed already. Failed at the first hurdle. We're doing this over Zoom. First of all, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for joining us. And Over the Influence. If you can see the book that I've got in my hand here.
I can. It's a great book.
It's a really good book. And can you see, Ben, just show us your book there.
There you go. I got it on the day of release, actually, this book. It came through my door on the day that it came out. Yeah. And it's fabulous.
I hope it didn't disappoint.
Oh, absolutely not. In fact, even the opening, the impact of alcohol on health is profound. Alcohol and medicine are inextricably entwined in the same way as money and banking. It's just, from the beginning, it grabbed me, and it's absolutely fabulous. Anyway, sorry, Sharon, I'm now fanboying. So, look, over to you. You're the professional journalist. Let's ask some questions.
Let's crack on. Thank you so much. I'm going to be completely honest with you now. I am rubbish at reading, Professor Nutt, as in making time. And I am up to page, in this book, 133, because I began reading it on a flight to Gran Canaria about 2 weeks ago. Since got home, family life got in the way, and I've yet to finish it. However, what I've read so far is brilliant. It's fantastic. It's so, so good. Before we get into the book and everything else we've got to talk about, would you mind just answering a question, and bear with the pronunciation on this? You're a professor of neuropsychopharmacology.
Correct. Well said.
Did I say that okay?
Perfect.
I had to break that down phonetically. Professor Nutt, what is that? What is it that you do?
Well, I'm a psychiatrist, but I study the effects of drugs on the brain. That's psychopharmacology, and neuropharmacology, depending on whether I'm looking at the effects of the drugs on things like thinking or movement or mood. So I look at drugs in the brain. Why do I do that? Because the brain, as I guess many of your listeners will know, is a chemical organ. The communication in the brain, the billions of neurons, 100 billion more neurons in your brain, communicate with chemicals, 80 different chemicals in the brain. So the way you study chemicals is to use pharmacology. So a drug like alcohol is a pharmacological mimic for some of the chemicals in the brain. So as a clinician, as a practicing psychiatrist, I use drugs to treat people, and I use drugs to explore brain function, because drugs and neurotransmitters are very sort of intimately interrelated. You know, one are based on the other. They work because of the other.
Thank you so much. I understood that. Thank you. What I love about your book, and I'm sure Ben will say the same here, it's an incredibly complex subject, alcohol. And the effect it has on us both mentally and physically. It breaks it down. It makes it readable. It makes it simple. Can we just start with one of the statements in it, and where it says alcohol is a drug and it shouldn't be taken lightly? One heck of a statement.
Yeah.
Not got much time.
Well, alcohol is probably the most complex or certainly the most promiscuous drug we know, because alcohol affects a very large number of different chemical neurotransmitters. I said brain's a chemical organ. There are about 80 chemical neurotransmitters. Alcohol influences at least 20 or 30 of them. And that's why it's complicated. That's why it does so many different things in different people.
And Professor Nutt, I hope you don't mind me taking you back to a time when...
You guys want to call me Dave? I mean, this Professor Nutt, it's a bit heavy.
I'd love to, Dave.
Call me Dave.
I'd love to, Dave.
I prefer that. Thank you, Dave.
But Dave, you were sacked from a role. How many years ago was it now that this happened?
She
went on the radio. In 2009. Because at that time, alcohol wasn't considered a drug, was it? When you said that alcohol was the most harmful drug in the UK on national radio.
And that's why I got sacked, of course, because the government didn't want alcohol to be considered a drug. It was excluded somehow from the Misuse of Drugs Act, but it was never formally said it wasn't a drug. Everyone sort of pretended it wasn't a drug. People were scared to say it was a drug. And of course, you know, I came along and said what I said and then got sacked for saying it, proving the others were right not to talk about it as a drug.
And why would you say that it is the most harmful drug in the UK for someone who's not read your work before?
Well, I would say what we did over the period of from about 2004 to about 2010, we developed scales for measuring all the different harms of different drugs. It turns out there are 16 harms any drug can do. 9 of the harms are to the person who uses it, and 7 of the harms are to society, to other people. And when you add up the sum score of all those different harms, alcohol comes out as number one. And that is because it's very commonly used. But the harms, particularly of alcohol to other people, are vast. And those harms are things like road traffic accidents, health costs, economic costs of hangovers. It's been estimated £20 billion a year lost to our economy simply by people whose cognitive function or work performance is impaired by hangover. So I would say almost every family in this country has been damaged by alcohol, either because they have family members who drink too much or have come into trouble from being drunk, or who've suffered at the hands of other people who have been drunk. So it's the massive social harms of alcohol that makes it the most harmful drug overall.
So just to clarify, by the way, Dave, Sharon can't get involved in this part of the conversation because Sharon is a BBC radio presenter and she has to therefore maintain, what's the word, Sharon, you have to maintain?
Impartiality at all times.
Impartiality, yes. She's recently had an update on her impartiality training at the BBC.
But that just come through last night? Carry on.
To clarify, it's not the most harmful in terms of physical effects, potentially, in terms of drugs that people are taking and using in the UK. But it's the, if you add up all the difference of the 16 harms that any drug can cause to both the person and to society at large, it's that accessibility of alcohol and that acceptability of alcohol within society that makes it the number one in your opinion. Well, that's, according to the work that you did.
And it's just say, it's not just us. So actually, after we published this scale of harms in The Lancet in 2010, we got a grant from the... When I was sacked, by the way, I set up a charity to do what the government didn't want me to do, which was tell the truth about drugs. I set up this charity called Drug Science. And we got a grant from the European Department of Justice to redo that scale of harms on the same drugs, but using European experts. And we came to the same conclusion. And then I recently redid it with Australian experts and came to pretty much the same conclusion. Each of those localities, alcohol is numero uno in terms of harm, and it's because of the social harms of alcohol. Now, alcohol itself is obviously harmful to the user, but there are more harmful drugs. I mean, the drugs like heroin, fentanyl, crack cocaine, crystal meth, they're more harmful to the user. They're going to kill you sooner than alcohol. But because they're not widely used, they don't cause the same level of social harm.
We will move off from politics shortly so that Sharon can rejoin the conversation, Dave. But I'd love to stay here for a little bit because we had William Porter on our podcast a few weeks ago and we were talking. He'd written a book, Alcohol Explained, but he's also recently written a book with Annie Grace about nicotine and kind of removing nicotine from your life. And I was asking him about the differences between the kind of government approach to smoking and to alcohol, because smoking has been gradually legislated against, hasn't it, in terms of the smoking ban that came in when I was about 18 years old. Mm-hmm. The warning labels then came in on cigarettes. It then was moved to cigarettes being behind closed doors in the news agency. You can't actually see cigarettes anymore. And it's starting to have an impact. Look, we can talk about the rise of vaping and the different potential effects that has, but let's not, because it's an alcohol-based podcast. But why do you think that alcohol hasn't been slowly legislated against in the same way that smoking has in the United Kingdom?
Oh, a very easy answer to that. It's the 6 cheap bars in Parliament.
Right. And so it's because the people in power drink, so...
Vastly subsidised. No, that was a bit tongue-in-cheek, but those are symptomatic of the attitude. We did a survey, I think it was probably about 1995. In those days, politicians were a bit more innocent. And we did a survey when we asked, I think we got replies from maybe 100, 150 politicians. We asked them things like, is alcoholism a disease or is it a failure of will? And they almost all said it's a failure of will. and we also looked at which of them had some kind of interest in the drinks industry. And we discovered, to our kind of horror, that the most popular club in Parliament was the beer club. Now, you might say, what is the beer club? And the answer is the beer club is a notional club whose members get each Christmas two crates of quality beer worth perhaps £100, £150. That's enough to stop the politicians in the beer club supporting any legislation that might change the regulations on alcohol. What has happened, and then going back to your analogy or comparison with tobacco, what has happened is that the drinks industry has learnt from the failure of the tobacco industry to maintain its sort of special status. It's done several things. The first is it stopped. It hasn't made the mistake that the tobacco industry made of denying the science. It doesn't deny that alcohol is a very dangerous drug. It simply says you should drink responsibly. If you don't drink responsibly, it's your fault. To which my riposte is always, well, most people drink to lose responsibility. And you know that, and I know that. They all know that. But they've also been very clever. They no longer give the straight subsidies as much to politicians. They don't. What they do is they do it through the hospitality industry, which is an enormous lobby group in Parliament. So you'll find many politicians who support the current stands on drinking get a lot of hospitality. They travel to exotic places promoting Britain and promoting things like whiskey and British beers and things. So the drinks industry has been very clever. In fact, they also do other slightly more sort of cynical things. Like they have a free bar. Diageo have a free bar in Parliament every fortnight, to which not only do they invite parliamentarians, but they also invite the leaders of, or the editors and senior members of the national newspapers. So the politicians and the newspaper owners drink together for free. And they kind of come to this unwritten understanding that drink is okay because we can cope with it, can't we? And, you know, it's only those wimps that lose control, those young kids that, you know, crash their cars because they're stupid. So it's been a sophisticated approach by the drinks industry to make sure that politicians never really ever get to discuss or to debate anything about alcohol.
Sharon, I'll just do some quick fire questions and then this is the politics over. Okay, because I can see you desperate to jump back in. Dave, do you like the phrase drink responsibly as a quickfire question? Do you think it says enough?
Well, it's not enough. Yes, absolutely. My preferred phrase is not drink responsibly, but drink mindfully. But that's not, like, you know, then you have to explain what that means. And that's why my book, I think, goes on to some of these issues as to how you can best understand your drinking and regulate it. But there's no way. Drink responsibly is the least powerful way of regulating consumption of alcohol, and that's why they got away with it. You know, basically a number of us academics, and you'll read about it in the book, 20 years ago came up with a list of things the government should do. At the bottom of the list was drink responsibly, but that was the only one that really got accepted because that's the only one the drinks industry would agree to, and they had, well, basically they have 50% of the people on the committee making decisions about the health effects of alcohol work from the drinks industry, which is why all the academics like me resigned because we thought it was a bit of a conflict of interest.
Potentially, Dave, potentially. do you think that alcohol should be labelled like cigarettes?
Yes, of course it should. Well, actually, the law says it should be, but the drinks industry fails to comply because they don't enforce it. You know, it should be stating things like it can harm the fetus. It should be stating like it can cause life. But the drinks industry has been extremely good at dragging its heels.
That's my big thing at the moment. I saw the research from the University of Stirling that talked about how if you labelled alcoholic drinks like you label cigarette, smoking, tobacco products, then it wouldn't necessarily stop current drinkers from drinking, but it would put off the next generation. It would put off younger people from drinking as much as potentially our generations have. Anyway,
no, you're absolutely right. But it is beginning to change. And I think, well, you know, obviously you've changed and your programme is changing. Or talking to people who've changed. The young people are now much more cognizant of the harms of alcohol than my generation were. And that is partly, yeah. I think I can take a bit of pride in the fact that, you know, I've been banging on about this for 20 years. It got me sacked. That was a dumb thing to do, really, getting me sacked, because people started asking, why have you sacked him? Oh, because he's telling the truth about alcohol. What's the truth about alcohol? But the answer is people are listening, and people are, you know, you can't escape that. It is a drug now. They changed the law. They've allowed the ACMD to at least consider alcohol. Not that they'll do anything about the considerations, but at least it's notionally a drug now.
I actually think, Dave, that, you know, when people are looking back at this period of history in 100 years to come or whatever, and they're looking at the history of alcohol in the UK and its changing habits, I think that you being sacked for saying that on national radio will be one of the biggest defining moments, because it is everybody. I remember long before I was interested in removing alcohol from my life, yeah, I remember reading about that story and thinking, blimey, this guy's really putting his neck on the line and saying it as it is.
Thank you. Well, I do hope you're right. I absolutely do hope you're right.
We are just going to take a brief break from this fascinating chat today with Professor David Nutt. We would love you, actually, to get in touch and let us know what you think of it. Your opinions are always invited. Drop us an email anytime, otihq@overtheinfluence.co.uk. Talking of very clever men... Ben.
Oh, a tenuous link, but I like it, Sharon.
Really tenuous.
I'm currently becoming cleverer. Do you know why?
Cleverer.
I'm becoming cleverer because I'm learning. I'm back in the classroom. I'm becoming a coach. We've launched OTI Coaching a few weeks ago, and we want to take this very short opportunity to tell you it's going really well. People are booking on for one-to-one coaching sessions, not just with me, not just with Sharon. We're mentors, aren't we? Because
I'm not
you're
qualified.
Not trained. You're not even training.
I'm not training.
I'm at least I'm training.
No, I'm not training. I'm not qualified in anything.
We'll get you on it next year. We'll get you on it next year. But yes, we've also got proper, fully trained up, qualified, accredited, alcohol-free coaches. Jenny, Sarah, Susan. They are fabulous and it's going really, really well. If you think that you might benefit from some one-to-one alcohol-free coaching, and look, it's not for everybody, that's totally fine. It's a bit like some people like a gym membership, some people like a personal trainer, you know? And this is kind of like, if you think you're a kind of personal trainer type person, then an alcohol-free coach, even for a short amount of time, might really help you out. Go to overtheinfluence.co.uk, click on the Meet the Coaches button at the top, and you can read a little bio of all of our coaches on there. And you can also book a chemistry session, which is completely and utterly free. You can book a chemistry session with anyone, as many of us as you like, just to see if you get on with us. The idea is that we want to support people who are embarking on an alcohol-free adventure, who think that actually a bit of one-to-one accountability, coaching, etc. would be helpful. So, Sharon, what's that website again?
Oh, funny you should ask. Thanks, Ben. It's overtheinfluence.co.uk, and click on Meet the Coaches. I know I said this was going to be brief. Can I just quickly say something else as well about Meet the Coaches? These are people that have they've been on the podcast. They have been community members for over 12 months. These are people that we know, we like, and we trust. And they are all qualified. And that is really important to us. We don't just sort of recommend coaches willy-nilly. I love that phrase. I really do. These are coaches.
I'm a father now. I should not be laughing.
Stop.
At the words. He's willy-nilly.
He's very northern and it tickles me a lot. So we don't recommend just anybody. These are people that are important to us that have been members, not just members. They've been very active members of our community for a long, long time. And they're just all fabulous. They're absolutely fabulous. So as Ben said, overtheinfluence.co.uk and Meet the Coaches. We said this will be brief. We've got a lot more to talk about with Professor David Nutt, or should I say, Dave.
Anyway, Sharon,
I am
let's bring
still
you back
here,
in politics over.
I am still here. I'm clutching the book here, and it's simply called Drink? The New Science of Alcohol and Your Health. What you've talked about there about people's perceptions changing over the years, it is an ongoing battle in many ways, and one that I've been part of. So what we've probably not told you, Dave, because we jumped straight into the chat with you on this recording, is that I'm just over 4 years booze free, knocked it on the head 2018. Ben's now a couple of years accidental sober, and I wouldn't have wanted to believe a word of it when I was up to my neck in alcohol. Not interested. But I do believe your book, it's not preachy. It's not a case of alcohol is crap, don't drink it. Basically, you set out the stall, you set out the pros and cons, and you go, there you go, there's the evidence, judge for yourself. But I would implore anybody, Dave, to turn to page 31 and just read the 47 symptoms of hangover. I read that and it took me back to a really, really dark place. It's medical, it's factual, it's just listed. Fatigue being number one, right down to suicidal thoughts and anxiety. That list of 47 symptoms of hangover makes for terrifying reading.
Well, you know, what I tried to do, I do drink, although I am developing alternatives, which I'm using more and more. And the fact is, alcohol wouldn't be so popular if it wasn't a good drug, if it didn't encourage social interaction and make people happy, etc. So I wanted to treat the readers as adults, tell them give them both sides of the story from the scientific perspective. Up till now, you know, it's all been very distorted. We spent 30 years fighting this myth that the drinks industry has put out about the French paradox and how alcohol can be good for your heart, etc. And it's been a huge battle against this, you know, massive disinformation campaign, but we've kind of won now. People now understand that alcohol is harmful. And so if you're getting pleasures from it, you've got to balance out your harms and your pleasures. And that's what I want people to think consciously about what they're doing, rather than simply pretend or, you know, put their blinkers on and take this, you know, the lead from the drinks industry that, you know, unless you're drinking, you're not enjoying yourself.
Absolutely. Like, because obviously you also own a wine bar with your daughter as well, don't you? You've got, you know, we'll talk about the alternatives that you just briefly mentioned there shortly. But I think that the way that we approach it is, it's not about, we don't preach that everybody should remove alcohol from their lives. For us, that's worked really well. We just want to normalize sobriety as a lifestyle choice. We don't want people to go, oh, God, are you ill? As the first response, is everything okay? Yeah. You know, I didn't know you had a problem, but I'm removing it because I want to achieve this, and I want to have clarity on this. Yeah. That's what we're trying to do.
Yeah, I got it. I mean, and I'm you know, very sympathetic, and I, you know, if for many people, abstinence is the best way and the only way. But I think there might be an alternative in the future. We're working on trying to find something which can give people the social benefits of alcohol with much less risk of the harms and the dependence and the hangover. And, you know, that I think in 100 years time, when they look back, that might be an even more important achievement of mine than getting sacked.
Can I just pick up on that, Dave, about the social benefits of alcohol there? Chapter 8. Are there any?
Well, I think so. And I think if you take most people and you say, list the sort of the 10 most memorable experiences of your life, probably half of them will have alcohol in, and probably alcohol contributed positively in most of those. So particularly in social situations, it does help people have fun in social situations. Most people, when they meet other people and want to engage in a relationship, are anxious. Going for a drink with someone is a good way of breaking down that sort of social inhibitions, you know, the icebreaker, allowing people to actually get to know the other person in a way which they might not be able to because they're too anxious up to that point or too scared. So I'm very sympathetic to the idea of having a social lubricant like alcohol, but I would just prefer it not to be as toxic as alcohol becomes over time.
Again, I'd just like to say there that I've spent a long time in many ways just relearning how to socialise, relearning how to have fun with alcohol. And when I've nailed it, it's been better than it was in the past. I mean, I'm all for talking about your alternatives in a moment, by the way, which I'm really excited about finding out about. But those socially awkward situations, that anxiety ahead of a night out, we've spoken to so many people during the course of this podcast. Yeah. And it's hell on earth at first. But once you've sort of done that without the social lubricant, without loosening up with a couple of prinks, it's a buzz in itself, Dave, in many ways.
Yeah, well, I don't doubt that. And And maybe that is a skill one could learn, and we can learn younger. And I think other behaviors which used to facilitate interaction, like dancing, you know, I take your point completely. And it may be that maybe you're right. Maybe that because we've always had alcohol in our social interactions, it may be that those good social interactions are seen as alcohol related. Maybe they would have happened anyway. That is a good, fair point as well. So, yeah, I can see that you could have a world in which you didn't need alcohol. I'm not completely convinced that everyone would have the skills that you've acquired or could have.
It's taken time, and it's not always been pleasant, Dave.
Okay. And you've got a lot of willpower, I'm sure.
The example I always use is that, because for me, alcohol was so tied up with my identity. I always like to say, Dave, that I don't think I had a drinking problem, but I do think drinking caused me problems. And I can only see those now that I've removed alcohol. Yeah. And for me, it's better. And I think, you know, another message that we like to share is that you don't have to have a rock bottom to decide to remove alcohol or rethink your drinking. You know, why wait till a rock bottom?
Oh, no. Absolutely agree with you. I think that's what's happening. A lot of younger people like you are doing that appraisal much earlier in life. Absolutely. Because, you know, and that's exactly right. That's what the book's about. You should kind of almost be appraising every drink you ever take to make sure it's worth drinking. And if it's not, don't have it.
Well, exactly that. And the way that I like to equate it when it comes to that kind of socializing side of things is that so many times I'd say, oh no, if I'm going to go to that club, I'm from Birmingham originally, and there's a club called Snobs, and you go in, Dave, and you walk down these stairs, and it was this grotty little club where it, you know, sweat would drip off the ceiling, and it was sticky floors, it was cheap vodka behind it was horrible, and everyone would say the same thing: oh god, if you're going to go to Snobs, you've got to get drunk if you're going to go to Snobs. And you think, well, actually, why do I want to go somewhere that I've got to be drunk to go there? To be able to bear being in that situation, I've got to have alcohol in my system. And now that it's completely gone out of my system, I'm 2 and a bit years into this sober life thing, I don't put myself in situations that I wouldn't put myself into. It means that for me, I can just approach everything and go, actually, I want to be here, or I don't want to be here, so I remove myself. I don't cope with things using alcohol anymore that I wouldn't cope with if I was sober. I totally get where you're coming from.
I'd be interested to know, and that's been self-talk, has it? Or has that been breathing exercise? I mean, how have you dealt with the social challenge?
I was very honest about it straight away. And I didn't say that I was removing alcohol forever. I said that I was going to do 3 months. And so whenever friends questioned me, I said, look, I'm doing 3 months. Yeah, but my story is I got to 3 and went, I feel really good. I'm going to carry on to 6, see what happens then. Yeah. Got to 6 and went, I'm going to carry on to 12. And it was on day 366 for me that I decided that, objectively, looking at drinker me and non-drinker me, non-drinker me was a nicer person. And I liked him more as well. And, you know, things had started to happen with work that wouldn't have happened. My relationships were starting to improve. I think I totally get that not everybody needs to remove alcohol to get benefits. And actually, you can get benefits from reducing alcohol too. I just want everybody to try a sustained period of sobriety. If you're thinking about your relationship with alcohol and you're thinking, actually, I am drinking a bit more because I'm stressed and it is more habit than fun now, I'd love everybody to try.
Well, that's a really good advice. I think that's absolutely, I think it's clear in the book. Yeah, don't drink to deal with chronic stress, because in the end, you'll have to drink more and the alcohol itself will become a stress. Yeah, absolutely good advice.
Yeah. But it is, once you remove it, it's amazing that the tangible changes that removing what is, you know, as you've stated, a drug, a poison, as soon as you remove it, the tangible physical and mental, but the kind of the changes that you can pinpoint and you can say, this is better because my anxiety is reduced, because my weight has dropped, because, you know, whatever it is, we just want everyone to give 100 days ago, Professor Nutt. Oh, I'm back to Professor Nutt now.
You've
sorry, Dave.
Formal again.
I forgot that we're friends now, Dave. We're friends now.
Dave, alcohol has been part of your medical research for some 40 years. Yeah. I mean, You must have seen some incredible lows, maybe experienced a lot of positives. And I just want to refer back to the book again. The chapter, Is the Future Sober? From what you've seen over the years, is it? Would you like it to be? Where's it going?
Well, my preference would be, I'd like to find an alternative. I think, and certainly personally, I quite enjoy the relaxing effects of a beer after a hot day, or a glass of wine, perhaps after a meal. I would like to be able to keep enjoying that, but knowing that the health risks are much less. And that's why I've been trying to find an alternative. I mean, when you think of everything that has ever been in terms of humanity, I think alcohol is the only experience that hasn't changed. We've talked about smoking, we've got things like vaping and snus and everything else, you know, all things around, you know, domestic life and work life. Everything has been disrupted by electricity and computers and things, but alcohol stays the same. And I feel that that's sad, really, because it's I think we could find alternatives, and we're working on them. And if we do, then we will be in an interesting situation, because we can truly then ask a question about whether there is a net benefit to the good side of alcohol, because at present there probably isn't, because of the harms.
Well, can you tell it? Is it Centia? Am I pronouncing it right, Dave?
So Centia is that's a botanical drink we've made at present, and which we're selling, and that's a drink which is a combination of herbs that contain molecules, compounds which work on the GABA system, the target system in the brain for the good effects of alcohol, and mimic that. You know, Centia is like drinking a glass of wine, half a glass of beer or something. And it begins to give you the social relaxation effects of alcohol. And we started with the herbal drink because the herbs have all been approved as food stuffs or food additives. So they're all available. They're all past the sort of food safety test. So we could actually sell it straight away. But what we're trying to do, what we have done, and we have invented molecules, pure molecules, single molecules, which could mimic the effects of alcohol. But we would have to take those through food safety testing. And if they pass that, which I hope they will, we will then have an ingredient. We call it Alcarel. So Alcarel is to alcohol like Canderel is to the sweetness of sugar. You get the pleasure without the pain. And the plan then is to to encourage drinks companies to license it. They can make their own drinks, but instead of having alcohol in them, they'd have Alcarel in them.
I mean, this could be an absolute game changer. On the press release, it says that this is a mood-enhancing 0% spirit.
Yes, that's right.
How does it work then, Dave? So what are the effects that you do get from this, and well, hopefully with Alcarel, what are the effects that you do get and what don't you get?
So what you do get are these, you know, that sense of a bit of muscle relaxation, your mind stops worrying, you become to be a bit chilled, you begin to maybe giggle a little. But particularly in social situations, it facilitates the social interchange so that you get more from it, which is what alcohol does. But alcohol, when you push the dose up, alcohol goes from turning on GABA to releasing dopamine, and that's why people get addicted to it, to releasing endorphins, which is another reason people get addicted to it, to blocking glutamate, one of the key neurotransmitters in the brain. It makes the brain work fluently. If you block glutamate, you stop laying down memories. That's when people get blackouts and they start falling over. And then if you keep pushing the dose up, you begin to, the glutamate block ends up stopping you breathing. So alcohol's has negative effects on most of the neurotransmitters other than GABA. We can avoid that because we can just target GABA. That's the clever thing. And even more clever, if you've got a moment, even more clever is the fact that, fortunately, and possibly deliberately, if you believe in some kind of evolutionary process, the parts of the brain which regulate sociability have a special kind of GABA receptor, which is different from the other parts of the brain. So we can actually target those chemically, pharmacologically, make a molecule that hits those, not the other ones. So we can get that specificity of targeting in the brain, which turns out to be really very useful and what we want.
Okay. So, sorry, please forgive my ignorance on this. So you you get the kind of the same benefits of, you know, those kind of the positive feelings that can come with drinking. So you get that relaxation side of things. Would you be able to drive using Alcarel?
Well, we would say you shouldn't drive if you're feeling chained in any way. I mean, driving is quite a complex skill. So you shouldn't drive if in any way your mood has changed. You certainly shouldn't drive if you've, there are plenty of medicines that people take which would impair driving. So we haven't formally tested Alcarel or Centia on driving, but we're not proposing to because we don't really want to encourage people to think that it's safe to drive, even if you're a little bit affected. It's almost certainly going to be a lot less impairing than alcohol, but not necessarily free of impairment.
So it's completely herbal then?
The current one's completely herbal, absolutely. Although these herbs, you know, we've been digging out the literature of, you know, Chinese medicine, Ayurvedic medicine, classical medieval herbalisms. And there are a lot of herbs out there that people have used for millennia to calm you, to help you sleep, to relax you, etc. We've dug into that literature and found the ones that contain substances. And in fact, a lot of the ones that historically have had this kind of relaxing effect do contain substances which work on the GABA system.
Right. I feel like I need to do more research to be able to have a conversation about this properly, Dave. So we're going to have to invite you on at another point when this is moved
forward. No, I'd be delighted to talk more.
And I think we'd be really happy to be guinea pigs as well.
Definitely. I mean, why don't you just send me an email with your addresses and I'll send you some scent in. You can see what you think.
You see, that's... And we're very honest on this podcast, Dave, and we always will be. And I know someone listening to this will want me to ask this question. And it's therefore only responsible of me to do so, regardless of my personal opinion. With Centia, is it mood altering or is it state altering? That's why I asked that question about driving. And again, you know, for people that want to reduce their alcohol consumption because they feel like it's having negative effects for them on body or mind, this could be an incredible alternative. You know, as
correct.
You said, the
correct. Yes.
I don't know. It almost raises not a moral question, but you know, it kind of a deeper.
Yeah, it does. I agree with you. You can, yeah. I
mean, Dave, I'm not as deep as Ben. I'm all for it at this stage.
You know, most people drink tea and most people drink tea and coffee, don't they? I mean, one of the. I'm not going to ask you, Ben, what other drugs you take. I mean, maybe you don't take any, but there are people that move from alcohol to other drugs, which are going to be more harmful. So anyway, the fact is, at present, you haven't a choice, but we can offer you a choice. And then you can deal with that moral dilemma yourself, all right?
Yeah. I think that's it, isn't it? And I think that's what I really like about your work. It's about educating people make an informed choice as adults.
Yeah.
You know, you are a responsible adult and you can decide what to do. Here's the information. You can decide what to do next. And I think that's what I really like about your work, Dave. And it's been absolutely blooming brilliant to speak to you. Sharon, should we fanboy and fangirl a bit at the end again, like we did at the start?
Yeah, Dave, would you mind? Sorry, it's a bit embarrassing.
I don't know quite what you mean, but go on.
We are big fans. We want
just
to tell you how big of fans we are.
Just big fans.
Well, I'm grateful and pleased. And thanks for communicating the enthusiasm and the book. Because, I mean, I don't know what you think, but I sort of feel that book should be read by every teenager, shouldn't they? You know, it should be part of the school, part of the sixth form PSE curriculum. Yes.
Yeah. It, like I said before, Dave, it's simple. I understood it, right? I am rubbish at science. I don't understand a lot of science. I read it. I was interested. I wish I'd read it much earlier on, actually, my alcohol-free journey, maybe in my 30s when I started to question the amount that I was drinking. I would say, to anybody listening to this, you know, maybe if you're sober curious, you're interested in what life might be like with alcohol, you're interested in what alcohol does to you both mentally and physically, read your book and then make your own decisions. It's not preachy, it's factual, and it's actually a really, really enjoyable read. So, Professor David Nutt, thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure.
It's been a delight for me as well. And anytime you want me back, I'd be delighted to come. I've really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Oh my God, I really, really, really enjoyed that chat. The only thing I'm slightly gutted about is that we didn't have the amount of time we normally have, did we?
I know.
But it was a very strict window of recording, which we jumped in with both feet. And we got on with Dave. Great, lovely, lovely fella. I'm hoping, this is just something I'm working on. I'm hoping to invite him into the community for a bit of a Q&A session with members.
Oh,
I know.
That'd be amazing.
I know.
That'd be amazing.
So leave
that with us. Different episode for us, but hope you enjoyed it.
I think that the takeaway for me from this episode is it's simply the science. It's read for yourself, because we only had a set amount of time. If you're interested in the book, if you want to hear more from Professor David Nutt, it is called Drink ? Look up Drink and you'll find it. Read for yourself about the effects that alcohol has on you, your system, your life, the impact on others. And then make your own mind up. You know, Over the Influence, we are big on singing about sobriety. Obviously, it's what we do. We want to normalise sobriety. We want to rid people of the shame they feel, the embarrassment, the stigma. It gets on our goat. Ben says it probably most episodes. Nobody needs to have a rock bottom in order to remove alcohol. No. It's becoming more and more of a choice, a lifestyle choice for so many people. And I just think that what Professor David Nutt had to say, it's factual, it's there. He's been working at this for 40 years. 40 years as part of his research. I've only been doing this for 4 years. And in that time, I've learned so much about alcohol, so much about the lies surrounding it, the lies you tell yourself. And I had to learn for myself what it was all about and the impact it's had on me. And I've had to relearn a lot of stuff in sobriety as well. Hands down, the best decision I ever made. It was my choice. And I think that's what this is about. Listen to the facts.
Yeah.
Listen to what people say. Listen to what the experts say. And you make up your own mind at the end of the day.
Mm. And of course, Sharon, if you are listening and you are sober curious and you want to choose to be alcohol free but think you might need a bit of help on that journey to start it off, then why not go to overtheinfluence.co.uk? Oh, yes, we're getting it in there again. Click on the Meet the Coaches tab and you can book some one-to-one coaching sessions with some of our fabulous Over the Influence recommended AF coaches. If you're a member, you get a really nice discount as well. Really nice discount if you're an OTI member on those coaching sessions, because, of course, our coaches are OTI members and they want to do their bit for the community, which is fabulous. So look, all the information is at overtheinfluence.co.uk. OMG, we just interviewed Dave.
Dave. Now, Professor Nutt, to me, I'm not comfortable with the whole Dave thing. He's a prof. Soz, full title every time.
Right, back to the inspirational stories next week, eh? The science, I love it, but also I'm quite tired at the moment because I'm a new dad and it hurts my head just a little.
Can I just say as well, you know, I'm in charge, she says, like I'm in charge of anything. I run the OTI podcast guest diary. Flipping heckers, Ben. While you've been busy changing nappies, I've been busy emailing. We've got some cracking guests coming up. It's brilliant, honestly. Even if I do say so myself. Really excited about what's to come.
See you next week.
Bye.